Chapter 9. Blackmail. Do you feel a creeping, shrinking sensation, Watson, when you stand before the serpents in the zoo and see the slithery, gliding, venomous creatures with their deadly eyes and wicked, flattened faces? Well, that's how Milverton impresses me. I've had to do with 50 murderers, but the worst of them never gave me the repulsion which I have for this fellow. The speaker is, of course, Sherlock Holmes, and the man he's referring to is the blackmailer Charles Augustus Milverton, the worst man in London. The story of Milverton was first published in Collier's Magazine in 1904. The date is interesting because the slithery Milverton was probably the first blackmailer ever to make his appearance in fiction. In fact, the crime itself was relatively new. A law against threatening to publish with intent to extort money was not passed until 1893. Though the word blackmail dates back to the time of Queen Elizabeth I, when certain freebooting Scottish chieftains used to extort money from farmers along the Scottish border. This protection money was called blackmail, or black rent, to distinguish it from the rent the farmer paid to his proper landlord. This was not actually a crime, the law taking the view that if a farmer chose to pay black rent, well, that was his own business. It was not until 1873 that the British Parliament decided that demanding money with menaces was just as unlawful as pointing a gun at somebody's head and taking his wallet. It may seem curious that English law, and this also applies to America, took so long to take account of blackmail, but the reason can be seen in Charles Augustus Milverton. Milverton makes a living by buying up compromising letters written by ladies and gentlemen in high society and threatening to send them to the husband or the wife of the imprudent writer. Holmes is engaged to try to recover certain indiscreet letters written by a young lady to a penniless country squire. Now she's about to marry an earl, and the blackmailer threatens to send the letters to the future husband. And in fact, real-life Milvertons were making money in exactly this way. A century earlier, it would have been absurd. People in high society took mistresses or lovers all the time, and nobody gave a damn. Then Queen Victoria came to the throne, married a serious and religious German prince named Albert, and all that changed. In England, high society took its tone from the royal family. The age of respectability had arrived, and there were suddenly dozens of things that were just not done. The breath of scandal could ruin a man and totally destroy a woman. Queen Victoria turned violently and passionately against her own son when she heard that he was having an affair with an actress, whereas her predecessors on the throne of England would have thought there was something seriously wrong with a son who didn't fornicate with actresses, chambermaids and ladies-in-waiting. But the First Lady of England, being a woman of only medium dominance, was a romantic, one-man woman who thought that sex was rather dirty and high society had to live up to her standards, or else. The case that made the Victorians aware of the curious legal problems involved in blackmail took place in 1872. The lady in the case was called Lady Twiss. The blackmailer was a London solicitor named Alexander Chaffers. Lady Twiss was the wife of Sir Travers Twiss, a well-known Victorian advocate and professor of international law at King's College London. She was regarded as thoroughly respectable. She had even been presented at court to Queen Victoria, and now, to the horrified incredulity of British high society, she was accused by Mr. Chaffers of being a common prostitute. Sir Travers Twiss had been a highly successful man of 50 when he met a pretty Polish girl at his mother's house in 1859. Her name was Marie van Linsaler, and she was the daughter of a Polish major general. 3 years later, Sir Travers was in Dresden and again met the pretty Pole. They fell in love and married at the British legation. On their return to England, Lady Twiss was presented first to the Prince of Wales and then to Queen Victoria. One day, when she and her husband were walking in Kew Gardens, a man suddenly raised his hat and said hello. Lady Twiss introduced him to her husband as a solicitor, Alexander Chaffers. Chaffers congratulated her on her marriage, and not long after, Lady Twiss received a bill for £46 from Mr. Chaffers for services rendered. She ignored it. He sent another letter, this time asking for £150. Lady Twiss showed it to her husband and explained that she really owed Chaffers some money for legal work he had once done for a maid in her employment, whereupon Sir Travers Twiss arranged a meeting with Chaffers and paid him £50, asking for a receipt. This was marked in full discharge. But Chaffers was apparently not satisfied. He continued to ask Lady Twiss for money. He wrote a letter to the Lord Chamberlain, the court official responsible for vetting the list of people who would be received by the Queen, telling him that Lady Twiss had been, to put it crudely, a French whore who had managed to worm her way into high society. The Lord Chamberlain was baffled. Short of hiring a private detective, he couldn't think of any way of investigating the story, so he decided to treat it as a hoax and to forget it. But he told Lord and Lady Twiss about the accusations. They were horrified and confirmed his opinion that Chaffers was a madman. Chaffers certainly had the persistence of a madman. He had a writ for libel served on Sir Travers, claiming that Lady Twiss had been spreading all kinds of slanders about him, and then went to the chief magistrate at Bow Street to make a sworn statement of the truth about Lady Twiss. This statement declared that she was actually a prostitute named Marie Gellat, and that she had been intimate with Chaffers on several occasions in certain houses of ill fame in Belgium. Now, as much as he disliked the idea, Sir Travers Twiss had to take action. In May 1871, Mr. Chaffers appeared at Southwark Police Court, charged with having published various slanders against Sir Travers and Lady Twiss. In legal terminology, published simply means made public. Mr. Chaffers' defence was that the libels were true. Marie van Linsaler claimed to be the daughter of a deceased Major General, and that she had been brought up in Poland and Belgium as the adopted daughter of a Monsieur Jastrzębski. Marie admitted that she knew someone called Marie Gellat. According to her, Marie Gellat had been her chaperone when she had first met Sir Travers. During that visit, Marie van Linsaler had fallen seriously ill, and Marie Gellat had decided that her employer ought to make a will. She therefore sent for Mr. Chaffers, whom she already knew, and got him to draw up a suitable document. This, said Lady Twiss, was the full extent of her acquaintance with Mr. Chaffers, and he had been paid his £50 professional fee after the meeting in Kew Gardens. Mr. Chaffers replied that there never had been a chaperone called Marie Gellat. Lady Twiss was Marie Gellat, and he had slept with her several times before she struck it rich. Well, nowadays, this would be an open and shut case. Mr. Chaffers was admitting that he had tried to blackmail Lady Twiss by telling her husband about her past, and then, when it didn't work, trying to blackmail them both. But in 1872, there was no law against blackmail, only against libel. Lady Twiss's problem was to prove that she was Marie van Linsaler, daughter of a major general, and not Marie Gellat. She called various witnesses to testify about her past, including a maid who swore on oath that Chaffers had tried to bribe her to support slanders against her mistress. Obviously, Chaffers was a very nasty piece of work, and the judge made no attempt to hide his distaste. And then, quite unexpectedly, Lady Twiss surrendered. On the eighth day of the trial, she decided she'd had enough. Her counsel appeared in court to tell the judge that his client had left London and decided not to continue the case. The judge had no alternative but to discharge Alexander Chaffers. He told him that for the rest of his life he would be an object of contempt to all honest and well-thinking men, but the fact remained, Chaffers had won. A week later, Sir Travers Twiss resigned from all his various distinguished posts. His wife had vanished to the continent, and as far as we know, he never saw her again. The London Gazette published a paragraph saying that Lady Twiss's presentation to the Queen, which had taken place 3 years earlier, had been cancelled, which was the Victorian way of saying that it hadn't really happened at all, and the case remains an apparently unsolved mystery. But it's easy to read between the lines. If Lady Twiss had been Marie van Linsaler, she would presumably have fought to the last ditch. The court was already inclined heavily in her favour. Her foster father, Monsieur Jastrzębski, had testified that she was Marie van Linsaler, and many of the other witnesses had declared on oath that they knew Marie Gellat and that she was not Marie van Linsaler. It was a foregone conclusion that Chaffers would be found guilty and sent for trial. What probably happened is that Marie van Linsaler, or Gellat, had bribed various people to appear in her favour, but that she realised a trial would be a more serious matter. Perhaps her witnesses refused to testify at a criminal trial because they were afraid of the penalty for perjury. She decided the game was up and vanished. If she was innocent, why did she tell her husband that she owed Chaffers the £50 for legal fees contracted on behalf of a maid when she later testified in court that it was her will that Chaffers drew up? On the other hand, there remains the other possibility that, persecuted by Chaffers, realising that she had ruined her husband, no matter what the outcome of the case, Lady Twiss's nerves snapped and she fled. The case made upper-class Victorians aware how vulnerable they were to blackmail. A man like Chaffers didn't need any evidence that Lady Twiss was a prostitute. He only had to say so in court. And even if he was found guilty of libel, her reputation would never recover from the scandal. It also made the Victorians aware that they needed a law to prevent people like Chaffers extorting money by threats, hence the statute of 1873 against demanding money with menaces. It cost Sir Travers Twiss his career, but his case had changed the law. Unfortunately, a change in the law was not quite the answer. When a crime suddenly attracts public attention, criminals everywhere wonder whether this is not a new source of income. The Victorian poor had always been the prey of rich debauchees. There were few working-class girls who could refuse the offer of 5 shillings for the use of their bodies. Now the poor began to retaliate by exerting blackmail on the seducers. Oscar Wilde was blackmailed by some of the working-class youths he slept with. When a homosexual brothel in Cleveland Street was raided by the police in 1889, the whole affair was quickly hushed up when they realised that one of the chief clients was the Duke of Clarence, the grandson of Queen Victoria. Eddie, as the Duke was known, was packed off on a world cruise, and endless possibilities of blackmail were averted. But it was not only the lower classes who indulged in blackmail. Aristocrats could play the game just as ruthlessly. One of the most famous and notorious of Victorian aristocrats was Lady Warwick, known universally as Daisy. The song Daisy, Daisy was written with her in mind. The ravishingly beautiful Daisy married the future Earl of Warwick in 1881 and became mistress of Warwick Castle and a huge fortune. She soon found her husband's passion for hunting and fishing a bore, and she began to take lovers. For several years she conducted a passionate affair with the dashing Lord Charles Beresford. In the Victorian age there was nothing to stop you having love affairs, provided you were discreet about it and avoided scandal. When Lord Charles finally broke it off, she went to his closest friend, the Prince of Wales, to beg him to help her get back a certain compromising letter. Edward, Prince of Wales, was the son who had alienated Queen Victoria through his affair with an actress, and ever since that time he had devoted his life to sexual promiscuity with the energy of a Casanova. He took one look at Daisy and dragged her towards the nearest bed. Daisy was willing enough, for although the prince was no longer young or handsome, he was fat and inclined to wheeze, she saw that he was a valuable ally. As to Prince Edward, he was genuinely in love with the delicious Daisy. In 1893, her father-in-law died, and Daisy became mistress of a fortune. She immediately had Warwick Castle re-landscaped, filled it with expensive carpets and furniture, and gave huge weekend parties that were famous for their extravagance. The socialist press attacked her for wasting so much money when the poor were starving. As a result, she went to see the famous left-wing editor W.T. Stead and immediately became converted to socialism. She had the double pleasure of being immensely rich and being known as a defender of the poor. As the years went by, Daisy's beauty faded and her fortune dwindled. In 1912, she realised that she was close to bankruptcy, and then she had her inspiration. She would write her memoirs, make sure that they were scandalously frank, and sell them to a publisher for some huge sum. £100,000 was her first estimate. In 1914, she contacted a journalist and writer named Frank Harris, now known chiefly as the author of the semi-pornographic My Life and Loves. Harris was not only an editor, a novelist, and a Don Juan, he was a completely unscrupulous blackmailer, and he instantly saw the enormous possibilities of her scheme. All she had to do was to make sure that she included the love letters of the Prince of Wales, later King Edward VII, who had died in 1910, and then ask the palace how much it was worth to suppress the book. 2 years earlier, a Tory Member of Parliament, Charles de Crow, had lent Daisy £16,000, and he now wanted his interest on the sum. Daisy also happened to know that he wanted a knighthood, and that he had an attitude verging on adoration for King George V, Edward's son. She sent for Ducrow and told him about the memoirs, and mentioned that she had letters from the late king in which, among more intimate and scandalous matters, he had given his frank opinion of such people as the Kaiser and the Tsar of Russia. Ducrow rushed to see George V's ADC and his solicitor. The solicitor suggested that he had better ask Daisy how much she would take to suppress the book. Daisy said £85,000, but told Ducrow that he would have to see her partner, Frank Harris. Harris had fled to Paris, escaping his creditors. Ducrot saw him at the Ritz Hotel and was told that they would settle for a mere £125,000. But the establishment had its own way of dealing with blackmail. Instead of paying up, George V's solicitor asked for a court injunction to prevent Daisy publishing the late king's letters. Daisy at first found it incredible to drag the affair into open court, but there she was mistaken. The establishment cooperated admirably. The case was heard in chambers, a closed court. Edward VII's name was not mentioned. It was simply a matter of preventing the publication of certain letters. The letters had to be handed over to the court, the injunction was granted, and the court also ordered that the letters were to be destroyed. This was not, though, quite the end of the story. Before the letters were handed over, Frank Harris went to stay with Daisy Warwick at her house, Easton Lodge. She had been forced by debts to move out of Warwick Castle. He asked to see the letters, and when Harris left for America, the letters went with him. In order to get them back, Daisy had to pay Harris for them. She was the loser all round. Her only consolation was that Ducrot, feeling sorry for her, took over £50,000 worth of her debts. Since Daisy's time, the art of blackmail has been turned into an exact science, particularly by the espionage and counter-espionage services of all the major countries. In the West, we hear a great deal about the techniques of the Russian secret service, the KGB. For example, how they blackmailed the American Army Sergeant James Harris, who appeared in the Rudolf Abel case, or of the pressure they brought to bear on the homosexual naval clerk Vassal. But there can be no doubt that the CIA and Britain's own MI5 are just as skilled in its uses. A favourite technique with both sides is to lure a diplomat or a member of the government into a sexually compromising position. The Russians are credited with the discovery of the use of the two-way mirror for this purpose. The English and American method was cruder, using a picture or a photograph with tiny holes in it, usually in the pupils of the eyes, with a camera concealed behind it. The invention of transistors enabled the CIA to perfect a whole new range of bugging devices. One of these was a tiny pill that emitted a radio signal. The girl, who had been chosen as the decoy, swallowed a pill that made a bleep noise. Another pill, which emits a bloop, is concealed in the food of the victim so that he swallows it. Agents are then able to follow the couple with radio receivers, and when their receivers pick up simultaneous bloops and bleeps, they can assume that the bellies of both parties are in sufficiently close contact to warrant a sudden intrusion. Blackmail is the least documented of all crimes, for an obvious reason. If a blackmailer is caught by the police, it's in everybody's interests to make sure that the case receives no publicity. And in most civilised countries, it's generally agreed that when a victim reports blackmail to the police, he will not lay himself open to criminal charges, even if he's being blackmailed for a crime that he's committed. Although this is a convention, not a law, it's seldom broken, the only exception being in cases involving treason. Slowly, very slowly, society is learning to combat the blackmailer. The day may yet come when blackmail, like piracy, is no more than a relic of the past.